This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
So I'm going to do a quick round of introductions, and then we will get to the presentations from each panelist. I'm Michelle Wild Anderson. I'm on the faculty at the law school at UC Berkeley, and I teach local government law. Our first speaker will be Mayor Loveridge of the city of Riverside. He's been a city leader since 1979 and mayor since 1994. Which, as you can imagine, means he's presided over a city that has nearly doubled in population and seen just enormous regional change over that period of leadership. He's a leader in several regional and statewide agencies, and he's a past president of both the California League of Cities and the National League of Cities. So we're very glad to have him here. Our second speaker will be Stephen Erie, who's a professor of political science, urban planning, and history, which in my business is quite a triple feat. He's the author of 4 award-winning books on urban politics and urban history, but he's also an expert on urban governmental structure, as well as state and regional water policy. Our third speaker is Mayor Chuck Reed of San Jose. He joined the San Jose City Council in 2000, and he's been its mayor since 2006. He has a distinguished prior career in the U.S. Air Force as well as in litigation. His public biography expresses affinity for the working poor and governmental efforts to assist them. I wanted to say something about that. But he's really made fiscal responsibility and good government the focal points of his administration. And finally, Raleigh Katz is with us. He's the supervising business agent for Public Employees Union Local One. Local One represents more than 13,000 local government employees in Northern California. He actually started at Local One in 1978, but left for a period of years to practice as a labor lawyer and returned in 2002 as one of their leaders. So we're very grateful for him being here as well. So thanks in advance to all of you, and we will start with Mayor Loveridge.
Well, first let me say thank you for those who are here. This is Friday afternoon at 4:30 after some 8 hours, and so my recognition to the survivors of this fiscal conference. Second, I just wanted to make a point that was made earlier, but to emphasize that no mayor would choose bankruptcy. It really is the last choice. In this business, competition is serious. You do not want to see your name in the headlights of this kind of conference, the kind of attention that bankruptcy brings. You can't compete for residents or business. Second point is that if you were here this morning and listened to the excellent kind of overview that Michael Coleman gave, I just wanted to underscore the view, and you'll see that in my remarks, of how important toxic politics is to explain how people get into difficult fiscal circumstances. Third point is the experience that San Jose and San Diego had with pension reform is different in Riverside. We had a table approach. We negotiated with a two-tier approach with each of our 6 bargaining units, and very quickly, I'd like to give you a kind of case study profile and with, I think, the point that emphasizes the great kind of variation you find among cities in California. First is just the difficulties of California cities also being played out across the country. The results of a what's called the 27th NLC's look at physical conditions of cities. When I was asked to come up, Max Nyman asked if I would do a little compare and contrast with Riverside with Stockton. We are the 12th largest city in California. Stockton is the 13th. We're both older cities. We're both about the same distance from the coast. Our demographics are comparable. So are unemployment numbers. Our loss in housing values and percentage of foreclosures are nearly the same. I'll provide much more information on Riverside than I will on Stockton. I did graduate from University Pacific in 1960. Personal profile. I guess the most important thing is I'm in my last. It's kind of interesting. My last 100 days. We talk a lot about the first 100 days of office. I'm now in my last 100 days. There's an interesting book out by Nancy Glibbs called The President's Club, which does it at the presidential level, but I haven't seen any literature talking about the transitions from one mayor to another. Riverside is a city of 300,000. We are about two-thirds non-white. We were originally a citrus town, and which Kevin Starr referred to us as the quintessential citrus town. We are a red city. There isn't a Democrat within sight line of western Riverside County. One might just the point when you start asking what are the markers of success of a city, one of those markers is what you do with the budget. We had a balanced budget, a $40 million surplus. We did negotiate with each of our bargaining units. In terms of numbers of employees, we have decreased from something like 2,500 to 2,200. We received many different awards. This past year, we were selected as a 2012 Intelligent Community of the Year Award. It comes out of a policy think tank in New York. Something like 435 cities around the world competed for this, and I could spend more time talking about it. We're also very proud of where we are in sustainability in terms of national competition. Basically, the argument I'm offering is that if you look for markers of success of a city, you'll find it in the city of Riverside. This is our budget statement, talking about the reserve and having a balanced budget and the ratings the city has sustained. This is a brief comment. This is one of the founders of the Intelligent Community Forum, John Jung. This is his kind of take on Riverside. He talked at In the Shadows of L.A., and you can see his sort of judgment as he drove in from LAX to Riverside. And then I sort of go through the kind of problems of our region. We build homes. While Detroit built cars, we're not building homes now. We certainly very high in foreclosures, a major drop in home sales, which affects property taxes. Retail sales have gone down. But again, the markers you have of a city not too dissimilar to those in Stockton. I ran up some numbers. If you're interested, I can send you the PowerPoint. This is sort of the demographic comparisons of Riverside and Stockton. Here's my argument, just briefly. One, it's not geography of whether or not a city is successful or not. There's a comment here from Chris Haney who says geography matters. I think geography helps. Our immediate neighbor is San Bernardino. It's 5 miles away. Victor Hansen, some of you may know, he's at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He had a column that circulated widely across newspapers of California. He basically says there's not one state. He drives from Palo Alto to Fresno, you find a much different place. And he's contrasting the Shangri-La of the coast versus the what he calls the pre-modern area of the inland area. Second argument, it's not simply demography. I mean, demography is not destiny. I think success of a city is more than SES. We are currently beginning to measure mark cities by educational attainment. I think education attainment is very important, and we're all kind of competing to increase the education rates. We have a $3 million grant from Gates Foundation trying to do that. There's an interesting book called Economics of Place to try to identify possible factors that account for success of place. I haven't done that to separate them out. Causality is always difficult. We are working very hard on a seizing of our destiny plan that focuses on quality of life and partnership and recognizing that economic prosperity is the highest priority of the city. But here are the two factors that I'd like to offer that are not geography, they're not demography. First is that political factors are important. And explaining, in this case, is kind of a case study, but cities, politics matters. And it's not the form of government. Riverside and Stockton have very comparable forms of government. The difference in Stockton is you're nominated by in the district and then elected large. In Riverside, you're both nominated and elected within council districts. So the first argument something that's kind of a soft measure, but I think a particularly important measure, and that's the kind of political culture, the kind of social capital you find in cities. And Riverside has sort of a long history of good government, to civic engagement, and as I measure social capital, high level. I particularly like Robert Putnam's call, and this quote comes from Bowling Alone, that social capital makes us smarter, healthier, safer, richer, better able to govern a just and stable democracy. There's something like 3,000 citations around on social capital, trying to understand it and explain it. But I think it's one of the explanations of why the city is successful. The second one to emphasize is the notion of political stability and civility. And in Riverside, we've had a high level of political stability. One marker is, I think, the length of time a city manager's remained, perhaps how long council members remained. Another marker is this question of civility and agreement. And as a result of this kind of stability, you've had good management in which services are well delivered. The premise is that very high levels of conflict complicate good fiscal decisions. Finally, the conclusion is that the good city in California is more than geography and demography. There are political factors that help explain economic and fiscal success or failure. I thank you for your attention.
It's been a long day. This is the last panel. And one thing I've learned is you don't want to linger too long between an audience and sunset cocktails. So I will try to keep, I'm half Irish, so it's only try to keep my remarks brief. I'm surrounded by mayors. I'll be talking about San Diego, and just consider me the anti-mayor. I am San Diego Mayor Jerry Sanders' most vocal critic. I was also a critic of Mayor Murphy, Mayor Golding, Mayor O'Connor, a long line. And we'll talk a little bit about the civic culture and the politics of San Diego. Now, go back 8 short years. John Broder's article in the New York Times, September 2004, San Diego was Enron by the sea. A pension scandal, a burgeoning budget deficit, a catastrophic growing pension liability, absolute chaos in City Hall, three mayors in 3 weeks, the forced resignation of the auditor and the city manager. That's September 2004. In September 2012, San Diego is being hailed as a budget and pension reform exemplar. My job as the contrarian, and also to try to sell books, is to suggest don't... I'm just about to get to that, but thanks, Chuck. The check is in the mail. Oh, Paradise Plundered, Fiscal Crisis and Governance Failures. Now understand, today in 2012, it's a success. 2011, when this book was published by an unnamed, prominent Bay Area university press. You get my drift, right? What has happened in the 8 years, or actually even in the last year, between the publication of Fiscal Crisis and Failure and now success? Well, let's first look at the budget issue. Mayor Jerry Sanders claims to have balanced the city's budget. Now, we have in San Diego at least a 25-year-long chronic structural budget deficit. We've been selling city assets, starting with the thing called Pueblo Lands, for years to make up the shortfall. This year, it's balanced. How did we balance it? Very easily. We borrowed from the road maintenance fund, and then we backfilled road maintenance with an obligation, a bond. No, we really haven't balanced the budget. We've just taken from Peter to pay Paul. And there's a larger normative question that needs to be addressed when you're talking about balancing the budget. And of course, you know, technically, legally, you've got to do it in California every year, but there's a lot of financial ledger demand, light-handedness and tricks with accounting to allow that to happen. But there's a larger normative question, and that is, and it was actually raised, it's part of the subtext of Mayor Loveridge's comments, the quality of public services. And they're shockingly inadequate in San Diego. And they have been for years. We have an unaccredited fire department. We're 22 fire stations short of meeting national accreditation standards. We have the smallest big city police department in the nation. I'm fortunate enough to live in La Jolla. I'm half Irish. I do my drinking in La Jolla. But I know that I can have that third or fourth beer and go the 8 blocks home with impunity because I know that there's only one patrol car per eight-hour shift among the 34,000 residents of La Jolla. The odds are in my favor. The last 10 years, we've seen serious deterioration in the quality of public services, parks, libraries, etc., etc. It's all in the book. But we have now balanced the budget with a little help from pothole repair. So the other claim to success, San Diego is the new exemplar, is a recently passed voter initiative, comprehensive pension reform. And what we did, what the voters overwhelmingly approved in June of this year, was for new hires to replace the existing defined benefit program with a 401k. Now, this also raises an issue that was beginning to get addressed with the previous panel, and that is the 401k system broken? and needing reform and restructuring. But the interesting thing is that we already had moved under Mayor Sanders to a two-tier defined benefit program. New hires for the last several years have gotten much less in the way of pension benefits. And the irony is that by moving from this two-tier system, and particularly with less generous defined benefit pensions to a 401k defined contribution, we're actually going to have to increase our pension payments. And why is that? It's because you need to go back 30 and 40 years to see where the roots of the current pension problem are. And they start not with City Manager Jack McGrory in what is called Manager's Proposal 1, 1996. They start with iconic Mayor Pete Wilson and the decision to move off of Social Security. And the way to get, and it basically the city saved money, you know, it was an automatic pay raise for employees, but the way that Pete got them to do it was, do we have a deal for you? Health care, unfunded. How are we going to pay for health care? We took it out of the pension system. Under Pete Wilson, we also put a cap on surpluses. Any surplus in terms of investment earnings above 8% would go into the general fund to pay for basic city services. Well, as we know about the market, what goes up comes down. And if you don't capture right those you know, investment returns as the market, as the bulls are running, what happens when the bears take over? Now, in the June election, it was pointed out that we have currently a $2.2 billion pension liability. And if you read the local newspaper, heard most of the politicians, you thought it was due to all-powerful city unions, greedy city workers, and Cadillac pensions. But you know, the city commissioned an audit of the drivers, the causes, the independent variables pushing the $2.2 billion liability. What did we find out? Half of it was due to investment losses. And there's a backstory here. And actually, I have not heard this discussion throughout any of the panels today. And that is the deregulation of public pensions going back to the 1980s. In a much more earlier regulated environment, you could only take so many of your chips to Las Vegas and play the casino. You put it into T-bills, you put it into bonds, not into stocks and equities. The great thing is when the bulls are running, everybody makes money. The city doesn't have to contribute. Look, I'm as guilty, as was pointed out on a previous panel, in the University of California retirement system. We didn't pay in for a whole lot of years. We're paying in big time now. But the point is that the chief driver was investment losses. The second driver, 35%, 50% was investment losses, 35%. This is the interesting story, was underfunding of the pension. And I've got to remember about sunset cocktails, right? Yes, wrap things up. 35% was underfunding, was diverting it into health care for city workers, you know, taking the surplus off. It also was what we call Manager's Proposal 1 and 2 in 1996 and 2002, where we continued the underfunding and then gave benefit enhancements, right, pension enhancements for city workers. But you look at the $2.2 billion, then only 15% of it was due to what we call retroactive benefit increases. This is Manager's Proposal 1 and 2. Now, going forward, there's a larger liability. But in terms of the current liability, not much. Now, What does the Comprehensive Pension Reform Initiative do in terms of resolving that $2.2 billion liability? Hardly anything. That $2.2 billion liability is for current retirees. You know, the pension changes, the reform, are for new hires. In fact, if you look out 10 and 15 years, it looks like, particularly if you have to make up the Social Security shortfall as you go to a 401k, that will actually be forced to pay more in the next 5 to 10 years. Going out to 20 to 25 years, the key element in the initiative was a five-year pay freeze for existing workers, which have long-term pension implications in terms of much lower, you know, salaries when they retire. So, you know, one of my dearest friends is Jeff Bowman, fire chief who resigned in protest in San Diego, lifelong Republican. And he said, "We are about to conduct a great natural field experiment. When you have all of the cities around you for firefighters with defined benefit pensions, and you have the city of San Diego for firefighters with a much less generous 401k plan, will we have recruitment and retention problems? Will we, as he say, in the city of San Diego, become like the San Diego Padres have become, with a very low payroll, a permanent farm club?" Stay tuned.
Mayor Reed from San Jose.
The subtitle for this afternoon's this session is Lessons Learned from the Front. So I'm going to tell you up front what the lessons learned, because I know that we're connected to the UC system here with this gathering, so I'm assuming there's going to be a test at the end. So I'm just going to tell you, you know, the stuff that will be on the exam up front before I explain it. So I've been at this for nearly 6 years, ever since I became mayor, when I declared the long-term structural budget deficit in San Jose as public enemy number one in my very first State of the City speech. So I've learned a few things along the way. I've paid a pretty high political tuition, and I spent a lot of time trying to figure it out. So lesson number one, that there really are two objectives in dealing with the pension reform. Two objectives. To me, both of equal value. First is we have to make sure that the employees get what they have earned, that they get paid what they have earned. Second, we have to deliver services, reasonable level of services, to the taxpayers and residents of our city. That is our mission. And to do both of those at the same time is what makes it really hard to find an answer. Now, if you want to do one or the other, it's pretty simple. But both are equally important objectives to me, so you can just take that into consideration as you listen to what I have to say. The second thing I've learned after hours and hours and hours and weeks and months of walking around this problem, looking at it from every angle, top and bottom, side to side, is the central problem is the benefit structure that we have is too expensive. These benefits cost too much. The cities cannot afford them, and the employees cannot afford them. And you can't solve this problem with actuarial assumption changes. As interesting as that argument is, it doesn't change the cost of the benefit. The benefits cost what they cost because the employees have earned them and you have to pay them. The third thing that I've learned is the only feasible way, I believe, to solve the problem, dealing with the costs, achieving both objectives, is you have to reduce future accruals for current employees. And you can do that with the percentage per year changes, stretching out the retirement age, slowing down the COLAs. There's several things you can do, but you have to deal with the current employees, and you do it with the future accruals. Because if you don't, you're not going to solve the problem. If you don't, you will do maybe what we did in the state of California, which was good, but it's essentially a 10% solution. And I have to work to that 100% solution, not a 10% solution, and I'll explain why here. So this is the background of what drove us to take the political risks, to do the fight, and it was a fight. You heard Bob Brownstein earlier. Trust me, it was a fight. Bob's an excellent representative of the union position in San Jose and a great example of how difficult it is to negotiate a solution. Unfunded liabilities. This is the optimistic scenario. 7.5% discount rate, 7.5% rate of return. $3.4 billion of unfunded liabilities as of June 2011. It's up since then because last year's return was not 7.5%, not even 0.5%. So it's up. Those unfunded liabilities are killing us because we're having to pay them off. This is a 10-year history of what we paid. This is not a projection. This is not assumptions. These are real dollars. $73 million to $245 million in 10 years. And if you've read the work that Donation has done, you'll see there are many other cities in the state of California that have the same kind of ramp up. That's big dollars. $245 million is what we paid last year and this year. This year it was flat as a result of actions we took the prior year. It's more than 20% of our general fund. And the cost per employee, for those of you who have to make a payroll, and there's probably a few people here who understand that, the retirement costs are more than 50% of payroll and going up. And this number is going up because the actuaries for our independent retirement boards are telling us the cost is going to continue to go up for another 10 or 12 years as we work off the liabilities, unfunded liabilities. How did we manage in 10 years with those great increases in costs? Revenues did not keep up with the cost increases. Therefore, we shrank our workforce. We cut 2,000 people out of our workforce. We cut cops. We cut firefighters, librarians, community center workers, you name it. We've cut them, mostly by attrition, but in the last couple of years, we laid off firefighters 1 year. The next year, we laid off police officers. Now, you know a mayor is getting desperate, and a city is getting desperate when you're laying off police officers and firefighters. And desperate we are, because this is an existential threat to the city. If you consider what the mission of the city is, to provide services to its residents and taxpayers, which I think is the mission of the city, continuation of that was a recipe for disaster. Continuation of that is a recipe for following Stockton, Vallejo, Central Falls, Rhode Island, and other cities into bankruptcy. And as Mayor Loveridge said, bankruptcy is the last choice. And we did not want to go there. This is how it played out in the police department. Public safety is our number one priority. If the fire chief is here, I say public fire is number one. If the police chief is here, I say police is number one. But public safety is our number one priority. There's a slide like this for the fire department. It looks pretty much like this. Police department, we increased the budget by nearly $100 million over 10 years, and yet we have less police officers working for us today than we had 10 years ago. We had money. We gave them money. Wasn't enough because skyrocketing costs. And you all know those costs are going up faster than revenues. That's going to come from somewhere, and it came out of staffing, 20% smaller police department than 10 years ago. So a little advice from outside third-party editorial commentary, Wall Street Journal. Some of you probably pay attention to what they say. So they're recommending the rest of California do what San Jose did, which is reduce benefits going forward. You got to freeze them, say, okay, you've earned what you've earned. You get to keep what you've earned. We reduce them going forward. And it's still possible today, as far down the road as we are, that we can still pay people what they've earned if we freeze what they've got now and make the reductions going forward. If we just continue to let it grow, we will reach a point, Central Falls, Rhode Island, where you call up the retirees one day and say, sorry, we're cutting your payments in half. So, yes, this is probably what the rest of California should do. So what did we do? As much has been said about what we did in with our ballot measure, Measure B, in June, which passed by nearly 70% of the vote. It really wasn't all that complicated. New benefits for new employees, hey, everybody's doing that. Over a couple hundred cities have done that, I think, in California alone. Current employees, they're going to have to pay more for their benefits. A lot of people are doing that. In fact, the state of California just said current employees for the state of California are going to have to pay more for their benefits. It affects hundreds of thousands of people. But as I said, the city can't afford the benefit and the employees can't afford the benefit. So when the employees start paying towards the unfunded liabilities, our employees are facing probably a 13% increase in what they're paying today, a 13% of pay increase in what they're paying today. They can't afford that, really. I mean, it's tough. It's going to be hard. They're already paying a lot. So we wanted to give them an option to switch to a more modest but still very good pension plan for future years. That optional choice is going to require the IRS to approve the changes in the plan. We're working on that, but the unions are trying to stop that at the national level, lobbying the Treasury to keep that from happening. Because the general strategy has been just say no. I think you heard that from Bob Brownstein earlier. Just say no will not solve the problem unless, of course, you believe that the federal government is going to step in with trillions of dollars and bail us all out. And if you believe that, well, keep praying. It's going to take more than prayer. So what still needs to be done in California from San Jose's perspective and the perspective of 8 of the 10 mayors of the largest cities in California. This is a letter that we sent to the mayor or to the governor and the leaders in the legislature. Is we need clear authority to be able to modify the future accruals of current employees. And we need the ability to give our employees a choice to go for a lower cost plan because they can't afford what we have. We can't afford what we have. What will that take? A constitutional amendment. Because the law of vested rights in California is unsettled, but it's not based on the language of the California Constitution. It's case law. We can change our Constitution and allow us to change future accruals so that we can pay what people have earned and accrued today. So that's what I think we need. That would be helpful to San Jose, helpful to other cities, and helpful to the state of California. And with that, you've heard the lessons from the front. There will be a test.
So apparently I'm the last thing standing between all of you and the cocktail reception, which is a hell of a thing to have to do, particularly on a Friday in a session that's, I guess, gone now over 8 hours. Please indulge me. I have not been here for the rest of the session. I actually got asked to fill in just a couple days ago, so I haven't had the benefit of hearing any of the panels. And if I'm repeating other things people have said, I appreciate your indulgence. First, Mr. Mayor Reed, I'm a Giants fan, but the A's need to stay in Oakland. Secondly, no on 32. I heard there was the opposite opinion expressed earlier today. It's not real campaign finance reform. It just will make corporations and billionaires more powerful and is really very, very anti-democratic. Chris Peoples asked a question in the last panel that was rhetorical about bailouts for Wall Street, but not for public employees and public agencies. I would say that really is more than rhetorical. I think that goes to the heart of the matter here. And I want to make that point. And I'd also note that although my wife and I have paid income taxes for many, many, many years, and we don't get any government assistance other than our home mortgage deduction and our charitable contribution deduction, which, by the way, our home mortgage deduction probably means we get more government assistance than a lot of people make less money. Despite that fact, she and I are both voting for the president. And our daughter, who's a little bear, UCLA Bruin, even though I'm a big bear, Cal Bear, she actually paid income taxes last year, made enough money, and she's voting for the president. So I guess we're in the 53%. I say all of that because I think when we have a discussion about fiscal problems in the state, and I'm not saying that pensions are not something we have to talk about, but when we have a discussion about fiscal problems in the state, if we don't talk about the real causes of that, we may as well not be here. The reason we have this mess in this state and this country is not because of public sector pensions, not because of public employee unions negotiating reasonable wages and benefits for people they represent. The reason is because this country has gone through the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression. And that did not happen because working people make decent wages and have a pension. That happened because of a deregulation of a financial industry, and yes, a Democratic president signed that bill, complete ignoring of those financial and that financial industry for a decade under the previous administration, tax cuts for the very wealthy for which there was no economic justification, and today we are paying for it. And I submit to you that not to diminish challenges that we have about funding pensions and other things, if we had had a robust economy, not even at the level of the early 2000s where property tax revenues were going up 8, 9, 10, 11%, but just it had the kind of increase in revenue that the state projected, I think, in 2007, we would not be having this discussion today. The California Budget Project, I think a year or two ago, said that if we had simply at the state level met the expectations, the projections that were made before the Great Recession, I think the state budget would have had $110, $120 billion in revenue rather than about the $80 billion. So all of the cuts the state had to make could be directly attributed to the economic downturn. Again, that did not happen because working people have decent wages and decent benefits. And if we want to talk about fixing things and we don't want to talk about fixing those basic economic facts, then we are spinning wheels. And when I made my allusion to the 53% or the 47% or the 1%, that, I think, goes to the core of the matter of any discussion we have about this. I think Governor Romney's off-the-cuff remarks that have been captured on YouTube really reflect the division that exists in this country. You know, most of us work for somebody else. Most of us don't own our own business. Most of us aren't entrepreneurs. Most of us work for somebody else. And it seems to me that today's, and I will be partisan, today's Republican Party, which is not Dwight Eisenhower's Republican Party, doesn't seem to care about anybody who isn't a, quote, job creator, close quote. But, of course, all of us are job creators because if we don't have any money, we can't buy the things all the brilliant entrepreneurs may produce. If we don't have any money, we don't pay as many taxes to local agencies to provide the services that all of us, or almost all of us, want. And if we don't have those important government services, there is no economic growth. This notion that everything we have in this economy is simply generated by some brilliant, hardworking people, and the hell with the rest of us, and it had nothing to do with schools, roads, infrastructure, et cetera, is so devoid of reality, and yet it's current currency and a part of our political debate. When I went to this university between 1973 and 1978, my parents, members of the so-called Great Generation, who moved from San Francisco in the early 50s to a town called Concord, where there were 6,000 people, so they could buy a house and raise a family, they paid $637.50 a year to send me to this university the first 4 years I was here. I worked and paid taxes, so I took 5 years to graduate, and I think the last year the tuition went up $50, and my deal with my parents was, since I'm taking 5 years, I'm going to pay it, but can I still live in home and not have to have any rent? They said yes. A few days ago, my wife and I wrote a check so that our baby bear could pay tuition for this quarter at UCLA. It's something around $4,400. I don't think that increase in cost is simply a function of UC Berkeley or UC System's pension costs being higher, or UC administrators' pay being out of whack, or fancy, and by the way, they seem to be much fancier than I went to school, fancy workout rooms for students. I think it has something to do with the fact that as a society, we have said we're not going to continue to fund one of the most important parts of our economic infrastructure, our education system. And oh, by the way, we're not going to fund roads and streets and everything else, because the worst thing that can ever happen to anybody is to increase your taxes. Grover Norquist, who's the guru of the current thinking in some quarters, wants to take it back to the way it was before Teddy Roosevelt, not Franklin Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt. And then he qualifies it, except for the tariffs. He says he wants to shrink government so it's so small you can drown it in the bathtub. And people sign pledges to him that say, I will never, never, ever vote for a tax increase. And yet public employees are expected to cut their pay, pay more for their pensions, pay more for their health care, or get out of the way and stop being an obstacle to reform. In this state, we want to do reform, let's change the two-thirds rule on voting for taxes. Let's give city councils and mayors the ability to raise taxes and let the voters run them out of office if they don't like it. When the aforementioned Pete Wilson, by the way, my father worked at UC Press, Professor. The aforementioned Pete Wilson was governor, and we had a problem in the early 90s. He and a guy named Willie Brown worked out a deal to balance a budget that required 50% cuts, 50% increases in taxes. Then Speaker Brown said, the governor's got to get some votes on his side of the aisle because I'm going to take a lot of heat in my district cutting programs for poor people. I can't ask Barbara Lee to even think about voting for it. Gray Davis proposed two-thirds cut, one-third tax increases, and we eventually ran him out of office. A few years ago, a few Republicans had the audacity to vote for a tax increase. They got recalled. So how can we engage in reform in that political mindset? Now, I got a note told I'm running out of time. Let me make a few other observations. I have said publicly, I say it to members of our union, government exists to provide services. It does not exist to employ people. Government exists to provide services. The people who work for government absolutely have a right to collective bargaining. They should be paid a decent wage. They should have decent benefits. And the measurement of decent wage and decent benefits is not necessarily, is it more or less than people make in the private sector? I saw a piece in the story the other day about the Chicago teacher strike. It says the average pay of a Chicago teacher is $76,000 a year, compared to an average of the city of Chicago resident of 42 or 45. The inference one I think is supposed to draw is, gee, they must be overpaid because they make more than the taxpayers do. My hunch is that $75,000 in Chicago gets you about what it does in Oakland, San Jose, San Francisco, and other parts of this state. And I think most of you know $75,000 in this area does not make you affluent. You probably cannot afford to buy a house if that's your sole income. So it's a completely false comparison. What do they make compared to, or with some in the private sector? Or the fact that awful lot of people in the private sector no longer have a decent pension. It doesn't follow that everybody who's got a decent pension left shouldn't have a decent pension. I thought the idea was to raise everybody up, not to lower everybody up. One of the great achievements in this country, which we are now walking away from, is that working people became middle class. And it didn't happen because of Ford and Carnegie and Mellon and Rockefeller and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. It happened, as Mark Shields, the commentator on McNeil Lehrer said, excuse me, PBS NewsHour, I'm dating myself. The bookends were the New Deal, the GI Bill, and the labor movement. People, if working people don't have money, this economy will not survive. My last point. I have said again publicly, we made a mistake collectively as a state in the late 90s when we had 10 years of irrational exuberance, where we had growth in the stock market, which nobody should have thought could be sustained. And we did at least two things that didn't make a lot of sense. One of them was we cut the vehicle license fee. No justification at all. Wasn't like Prop 13 trying to address property taxes raising because of inflation of home values, not because taxes are being raised. And, yes, I say this. We made some improvements in pension plans based upon a level of stock market return, which I don't think anybody should have thought was could continue. Similarly, in the 2000s, I think the 90s were the greatest growth in the stock market. In the 2000s, I've been told by an investment person, is the greatest decline in the stock market. We've had two major hits in the stock market in the 2000s. So just as we should not have made long-term decisions based upon irrational exuberance of the 1990s, we should not overcompensate by making irrational decisions based upon a 10-year period where the stock market declined in a manner that is unprecedented. There will be economic growth. I'm not suggesting economic growth will reduce all of these numbers completely, but there will be economic growth. And that decline, you know, these costs we see on pensions, even if pensions had never been improved in the late 1990s and early 2000s, even if we had the same formulae then, we would have seen this kind of curve. It would have started at a lower place. We would have seen this kind of curve because of losses in the stock market, not caused by working people, not caused by the mayors. I have told our members who are very, you know, the case studies, if I'd done case studies, I would have just given you a list of all the agencies where we represent people, where workers have agreed to cut their wages, pay more for health care, pay more for pension, agreed to new tiers for new hires, given up retiree medical, people who work in school districts who work 6 or 7 hours a day, custodians, bus drivers, food service people, who now are paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars for their health care or who have lost their health care at all. That would be my case study if I put a PowerPoint together. But I tell our members who complain about their employer wanting to cut things that their employers, public agencies, are the victim of the same economic mess they are victims of. And until we fix that economic mess, we can have all the programs like this in the world and we're going to have the same problems. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much to everybody. That was terrific. So we'll take questions from the audience, and I have a couple myself, if you guys don't have any. Are there any new speakers? Okay, great. Thank you.
This is a question for Mr. Katz. Mr. Katz, I agree with everything you said about the root causes for the current crisis, but given the current political environment, what do you propose should be the solution, especially short-term solution for the pension crisis?
I think short-term solutions are very difficult because, particularly when it comes to pension, I think the only thing that really does anything to drop that number in the next year or two is either to have employees pay dramatically more than they're paying now, which doesn't drop the number, it just means the employer doesn't pay as much. Or, and this may be get me in trouble in some quarters, I haven't looked at all the numbers Mayor Reed talked about, but it may be that something as drastic as current employees changing their benefit going forward would have some significant effect. But I think absent basic improvement in the economy, we're going to continue to strong along for the next few years. And at some point, you just can't go to employees and say, you've taken cuts now for the last 5 or 6 years. You've got to take more cuts. So at some point, and it's happened, I know. I mean, we see the chart. You know, public agencies are going to have to make more and more difficult decisions about what levels of services we can afford to provide.
I have a question for Raleigh Katz. We have something in common. We both must be part of the 53%. I pay taxes. I have kids. Both are earning money. They pay taxes. And all of us are voting for the president.
Good.
Now, as to substance, I wanted you to explain something to me. Over the last 10 years, CalPERS has earned 5% per annum. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is 2,000 points higher than it was in 1999. It closed December 31st, 1999 at 11,500. It's 13,500 now. It's very close to where it was before 2008. So you said we're having all these problems because stock markets are down, even though CalPERS earned 5% per annum for the last 10 years. Can you explain to me how that can be, that they can earn money and stock markets can be back to where they were before the crash and higher than they were 10 years ago, and yet that's the reason we have increased pension costs? Thank you.
I think you know the answer, and maybe that's a setup. So if you, yeah, so your answer is if you assume a 7.5% rate of return and you only earn 5, you have unfunded liability, right? So what did CalPERS earn over the last 30 years or the last 20 years? And I think over the last 30 years, it earned something close to the 8% that we talk about. But let's take that a step further. So let's say, so if the stock market is back to where it was just before 2008, then it hasn't earned any money in 5 years. And I have this discussion with our members.
who say, but they're making money now, and if they're going to have excess earnings. And if you look at the plan I'm most familiar with, Contra Costa System, the last 5 years they've had zero, they've had 18, they've had 12, et cetera, right? So if you had the same amount of money in your personal investments now that you had in 2008, you wouldn't be real happy with that, right? So let's say...
Do you want the answer?
Yeah.
The answer is they made a lot of money in fixed income. Interest rates plummeted, so their fixed income portfolio rose a lot. So even... And they also earned dividend income. So there's nothing you can really say. They earned 5% per annum. What you said at the beginning is 100% right.
So let's...
They earned 5% per annum for the last 10, 12 years, but they assumed they were going to earn 8.
Yeah.
They were at 8, of course. And that's the reason.
So let's say...
The only reason.
No, but if the assumption was that the, so you're saying they were made the wrong assumptions on stock.
Yeah.
All right. So again, we had many years, and I see Mr. Bornstein back there, and we've had this discussion. All those years in the 90s where they earned in excess of what they assumed, the taxpayers of that year were subsidizing future taxpayers. Now, it's a longer debate, probably enough time here to talk about pension holidays were a mistake or what would have happened. But let's say that all those, let's say there had been a 5% assumption rate rather than 8% the last decade. We would not have any unfunded liability, right? However, all the public employers would have been paying much more money each of those years for their pension obligations. So you would have paid it over the last 10 years. Now, they wouldn't be paying it back at an unfunded liability at an interest rate, but each of those years, they would have paid more money. Contra Costa County in the 90s built up reserves. Contra Costa County retirement system gave what some might call a pension holiday, not completely. They subvented the COLA portion as opposed to what PERS, some cities do with PERS. But Contra Costa County built up very healthy reserves in that time. And when we had declines in 2002 and over the next 7 or 8 years when there were budget shortfalls every year, the county was able to take out of those reserves every year to soften the effect on services. Had they put all those reserves in the 90s into the unfunded liability, their pension costs would be less today, but they wouldn't have had the money the last 7 or 8 years. So I'm not sure, somebody would have to get out pencil and paper, but I'm not sure they'd be any worse or better off. But you are correct. If the assumptions were lower, there wouldn't be the same level of unfunded liability.
Hi.
And if you lowered the assumption today to 5%, it would not do the mayors any good the next 3 or 4 years because their pension rates would go way up in budgets they can't afford anything.
Hello, my name is Barrett Wall, and I teach entrepreneurship for engineers at UC Berkeley. And there's this risk-reward ratio. And I think, you know, if you're investing your money and there's an upside and a downside, then you probably would say, well, there's a thing called the efficient frontier, where you get a higher return for more risk. And if you want the stability that, and not the risk, there should be one set of rewards. And if you're willing to take a risk, there should be an upside on it to incentivize people to do it. So you can either get the stability of a pension, or, and then when things go up higher, you say, well, I want to get that reward. And then when that reward doesn't come, then there's a risk factor. So there should be probably a combination in the pension funds where there is a reward if the economy goes an upside, and if everybody is faltering with 401ks because the economy isn't doing, everybody should be a player of that. And the way I think to get out of this mess is starting companies that provide new jobs and offer a higher tax base that we can then have more resources to expand. That's, yeah.
Anybody want to comment on
question.
That?
Yeah. That won't solve the problem. It costs too much money. So you start all the companies you want, and all the tax revenues are not going to go up nearly fast enough to cover the increase in the growth. And we spend a lot of time in San Jose trying to help new companies start and build a tax base. But that will not solve the problem for local government. We don't have an income tax, for example. So sales tax, property taxes, they're not going to go up as fast as the economy. So we're always going to be behind the power curve on the revenue side. I have one thing I wanted to add. David Lowe works for me. If you have a question about anything I've said or you think I've said or what we did in San Jose, call my office and talk to David.
1-800.
Call David. Hey, we have a question.
Hi, Ed Mendel. I've got a blog, calpensions.com. A question for Mayor Reed, if I could. What's the status of the implementation of Measure B? You mentioned you need the IRS approval of the option. I think there's also one or more lawsuits. And when you said a constitutional amendment would be helpful to San Jose. Are you suggesting that you may not get what you need legally to actually implement the measure?
Let's see, three or four questions there. First, the status. Measure B was a charter change. So Measure B set the parameters of a variety of things, and we still have to do ordinances and details, and a lot of that's got to be negotiated and worked on with the retirement boards. So we are anticipating getting those ordinances done for effective date the 1st of January. We have five or six lawsuits. Five or six of our unions filed lawsuits in state court. We filed an action in federal court. We're now sorting out which courthouse is going to move those ahead. So we haven't yet got to argue the merits of the case. But there is a constitutional issues that the unions have raised on vested rights. And, of course, to the unions, everything is a vested right. They believe that what you had in your brain about what you were going to earn the day you were hired 30 years ago is what you're entitled to for, you know, the next 60 or 70 years. And I think that's an extreme version of vested rights, but that's their position. So there'll be this vested rights argument in the case. But San Jose's in a little bit different position than others because under the state charter or the state constitution, we're a charter city. We have complete authority over compensation. Our charter says we can roll back retirement benefits. Especially reserves that right to the council. We have made our employees pay more in the past for their retirement benefits. And so we're going to have an interesting fight. Nothing important in California happens without litigation. So it's no surprise. So we're not counting the money and we're not spending the money. But I do anticipate having savings in the next fiscal year with that as these cases you know, get resolved at the trial court level.
May I add a couple thoughts? One, the question of vested rights, so folks understand, is there's a series of court decisions that say there are certain things which are vested rights, and therefore under the Constitution's contract clause, they can't be taken away unless employees get something of equivalent value. And, of course, what is equivalent value is not defined, although my understanding of the case law is there's great deference given if it's negotiated between the union and the employer. So the easiest way to address that is to do it at the bargaining table. Now, I observe San Jose from a distance, but I will say collective bargaining is the best way to get these things done.
I agree with you on that. It just won't work.
And my guess is, Mr. Mayor, that some folks on my side might say it didn't work not just because of them, but because of others. So
I'm not giving the reasons. I'm just saying it didn't work.
Just the outcome.
We had 20 sessions with the state mediator, so you know, they gave it their all, and it just didn't happen.
And the so I think that's the vested rights argument, and I think you had another point that's lost me, so we'll go to the next person that has the next question.
I actually want to intervene with a question. I'm young and thus naive, and I'm a university professor, which means that I'm somewhat distant. And I just want to observe that I mourn the divisions on this panel. I mourn the divisions that have been represented throughout the day, because the dual interests between the cities and its employees are so evident to me. I just want to say that. And along those lines, I just want to sort of make a sort of observation slash question, which is that one concern I have about the current recession and about the conversations around the recession's impact on cities in particular is that because workforces have been slashed and because the quality of services have gone down, and you express your regret over those losses, but expectations from voters remain high or at least stable. We have this shrinkage in the local public sector and a cyclical problem in which voters will continue to return to the ballot box to tie the mayor's hands on the revenue side. And it strikes me that some of the sort of political divisions that we've seen today are the source of that destructive cycle. And anyway, if you have any comments on that.
And the other thought came back to me. I'll get in a second. I say to people all the time, it is in a union's interest that its members' employer is financially healthy. It doesn't matter whether you're a private sector employer or a public sector employer. I think that our members and most of our members' employers, be they their managers or their elected officials, share some common interests and they want to provide the services that we want to provide. Senator Hancock has often described a structural deficit as the difference between the amount of money it takes to provide the services that people want and the amount of money that people actually are willing to pay. It's a whole other panel, but, you know, we have this crazy ballot box budgeting in California. All of those things, I think, go to that, and they do make the challenges for the mayors and the council members and everybody else much more difficult than they need to be. And, you know, we do everything in an election cycle in short term. I heard somebody commenting a week or two ago about the presidential campaign who said, I don't want to hear about each month's unemployment numbers. I want to hear what your plan is going to do over the next how things are going to look 6 or 7 years ago. Our system doesn't, you know, our political system doesn't really allow us to have that conversation. Other than in buildings like this and the Public Policy Center, we don't have real public policy decisions. We are all driven by the politics. The other thing is, change is very difficult for anybody. Our health care system in Contra Costa County is putting in an electronic medical record system. If you have Kaiser, at least in Northern California, you already know about that system. But changing it is a huge task, and it's causing all kinds of havoc. So when you ask people, I don't think anybody should be surprised that when you tell people, well, here were the rules for 25 years, here's the pension you thought you were going to get. You negotiated away a pay raise several years ago in lieu of so the employer would pay more for your pension. Or you didn't get as big of a pay raise because we improved the pension and improved health care. And now you say, sorry, that deal is all gone. I don't think it should be a surprise to anybody that that's difficult. And the answer, the other point on the other issue you raised with the mayor, the IRS issue. Ironic. In Contra Costa County, we've actually tried to set it up so that current employees can go into the lower pension tier, and we haven't been able to because of this. I won't bother you with the arcane. There's an IRS regulation about or ruling on something called constructive receipt. And until that's changed, new hires can't have an option of going into the less expensive pension plan without there being serious tax consequences.
IGS tells me we need to wrap up. I'm sorry, but thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.